Welcome to episode 5 in the 5th season, Justice with John Carpe, the podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with us today is lawyer Marty Moore. Marty is here today to bring us up to date on the Parental Rights and Gender Transition file. He follows these issues closely from many angles and through many legal cases. The big news, of course, is the announcement out of Alberta at the beginning of February concerning gender policies for children. These are still to come as they are not put into legislation yet. They're under a wide range of subheadings with relation to parental rights, transgender supports, surgeries, hormone blockers, and female spaces in sports, etc. Marty, tell me, what do you see is in store for us?
Yeah, that's right, Kevin. We have quite a interesting legal, constitutional, political conversation happening. Of course, we've seen the recent announcement from Danielle Smith here in Alberta, which mirrors in some ways the policies that were first announced by Premier Higgs in New Brunswick, which there's a court case, our team's involved in that matter, against the parental notification policy. And then, of course, we saw Saskatchewan that announced similar policy shortly after that. There was a court decision, and the court case is kind of still going on. But, of course, the Saskatchewan government enacted legislation grabbing Section 33 of the Charter, which immunizes legislative action in Canada against being struck down by courts who would find grounds under different charter sections to do so. So that's the Saskatchewan New Brunswick history. And now up to Alberta, we've seen a broadening of the conversation with policies directed, for example, at not only school issues regarding the transition of children, but also how do you protect women's sports, and more broadly, the issue of medicalizing cases of gender dysphoria. When is it appropriate and not appropriate to give cross-sex hormones and puberty blockers and surgeries? And so much broader conversation being opened up here in Alberta, and you can see now the Ontario government is being asked about these things. So, you know, it's a political conversation that obviously raises quickly legal issues, because anytime these policies have actually been announced or adopted, a legal case has been very quick to follow.
Okay. Now, I understand there's none following yet in Alberta because it hasn't been passed. I do know that it looked like the Ontario government was running from this conversation as quick as they could when they were asked about it. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I think the Ontario government is a bit wanting to have it both ways from what we can tell. They are wanting to make the right statements that parents want to hear. And parents, I think, rightly want to hear that their kids aren't going to have their names changed, their sex identification changed, without their knowledge and consent, by strangers, by people in schools, by a counselor they've never heard of. But we all know that's going on. And the Ontario government knows that it's going on. It's going on to such an extent, Kevin, in Ontario schools, that a public school board trustee who raises a concern about these issues, about why don't we tell, for example, one trustee, her name was Linda Stone, she raised a concern in a public school board meeting saying, why don't we tell parents that we're not going to tell parents when the schools change their kids' sex identification in school? And for raising those kinds of concerns, she was sanctioned, disciplined by her fellow trustees. And yet the Ontario government will come out with a statement that says, you know, look, we support parents being fully involved, but we're not going to do anything. Well, you know, it's a provincial responsibility, education is. And when you know that school boards are intentionally running roughshod over parental rights and also trying to keep that fact in the dark, well, then I think you can see which side the Ontario government has picked on this issue. And it's not the side of protecting parental responsibility and children's rights to that parental responsibility, because that's where the constitutional issue comes in. It's not simply a question of policy, you know, who should be naming children, who should be changing their name, who should be you know, putting them on a path of gender transition or sex identification transition. Who should be making these decisions? The question isn't what's the best policy. The question is actually a matter of constitutional law, and our law and our constitution has, you know, from really time immemorial, recognized that is the parent's responsibility to care for their child. You know, who names the child? It's not the state, it's the parents. And so who's going to change that name? Well, now there's an assumption that it's the state that has the right to change that child's name. Whose responsibility is it to support a child with gender dysphoria trying to understand their own identity? Well, the law's presumption would be, in all other areas, that the child is entitled to the informed care of the parent. That's a constitutional principle. It is a recognized parental right, because once you have a responsibility in law, parents, if they neglect their children, are under criminal sanction for that neglect. They have a legal responsibility to care for their children. And when you have a legal responsibility, it follows that there's a legal right protecting your ability to carry out your responsibility. And our law also recognizes that informed consent of parents to fundamental decisions in a child's life is also a right of the child. We know that children are developing physically, mentally, emotionally, and aren't capable of making adult decisions. That's a presumption in the law as well. But what we've seen more recently is that you could have politicians coming out. I think you might have seen the clip. Canadian law doesn't recognize parental rights. You know, Well, that's coming from, I believe, MP Randall Garrison, an individual who would criminalize and did participate in the drafting of the conversion therapy, quote unquote, bill that passed the parliament by unanimous consent, which would, if applied, essentially criminalize conversations that people would have with their own child about gender identity, about gender expression, if those conversations happen to be following traditional values and views on biological reality, for example.
Well, to this constitutional question, I don't know whether you saw this or not, but there is a story today in the Edmonton Journal, which is Alberta law professors believe province's planned transgender policies violate charter rights. And starts off with 36 Alberta law professors, legal researchers, and staff. Well, I don't know how many are law professors or how many are staff. They signed this letter saying that the province's forthcoming transgender policies violate multiple sections of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So they're basically saying, well, you know, it's pretty obvious the constitutional question is settled science or something. Sorry, just to bandy about a phrase. But anyways, yeah, they're obviously seeing this as a constitutional battle as well. So I guess it's headed to court and these ideas are going to be tested. There's no doubt about it at this point.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely going to be a court application against any move that would protect that parental child relationship in schools and in regard to really these issues of sex and gender. And I think, you know, the idea that we're going to sign a letter and we are going to push our weight around as, you know, members of the legal community to say that, no, having parents be notified and give their consent for those under the age of 16 to change their name and sex identification in school is unconstitutional. We have seen those kinds of arguments raised. And Kevin, in Saskatchewan, there was an injunction issued against parental consent and notification for the name change and the change of sex identification in school. And that is really quite shocking, to be honest, because we have, you know, established jurisprudence. And, you know, just to give listeners a little flavor of how established our jurisprudence is on these issues. You know, here's the Supreme Court of Canada writing not all that long ago, but, you know, back in the 90s when we were dealing with these issues. And it said, here's Justice LaFleurie saying, I would have thought it plain that the right to nurture a child, to care for its development, and to make decisions for it in fundamental matters, such as medical care, are part of the liberty interest of a parent. And it's hard to, you know, think of a more fundamental matter than someone's sex identification and name. Like that, those are pretty fundamental matters to the identification and to the, you know, just the core identity of a child. And of course, you know, the law, Justice LaFleurie went on to recognize that the common law has long recognized that parents are in the best position to take care of their children and to make all decisions necessary to ensure their well-being. And what we have these law professors and even a court in Saskatchewan saying is that, no, actually, we are going to say that there are certainly situations. They don't list these situations. They don't identify them. There are situations where parents don't know best. And if a parent is informed of the deep distress and confusion that a child is going through, well, then those parents are going to be harmful if they don't immediately change that child's sex identification and name at that child's whim and request. And so they are the ones who are overturning this historical protection, this, you might say, common sense protection that children have enjoyed from parents and in the law. And of course, the law is that, and this is to quote the Supreme Court again, the view of the child's welfare conceives it to lie first within the warmth and security of the home provided by his parents. Like, these are foundational precepts of law that are being thrown out by these legal scholars and in some cases courts in favor of, you know, invented rights, not to be quote unquote dead named, invented rights to a gender identity, something that the law has not even fully defined or comprehended. Not to mention gender expression, another term which you don't find it in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and to begin to provide constitutional protection to that without definition and without regard to the context of a minor. You know, you get into very novel territory, and these rights are not being exercised against the state. These rights are being exercised essentially against parents who, unless the courts are going to find them to be a danger of their child, have these fundamental charter rights protected under Section 7, which is the liberty interest of families, really, a family unit where children's rights are intertwined with parents' rights for the care and protection of those children. And of course,
well, in just glancing through this article in the Edmonton Journal that I cited, I noted that they are using a similar type argument in their letter that is being used in the Saskatchewan case. And here is the sentence. This is quoting from the letter. These restrictions will harm two-spirit, trans, and gender-diverse children and youth by undermining their education, restricting their access to health care, and narrowing their sport and recreational opportunities. So it's this harm idea. And in Saskatchewan, I was actually discussing this with John Carpe on another podcast. We were noting that they were using the people defending our fighting on behalf of UR Pride were using this term harm. They were using it in the sense of cruel and unusual treatment or cruel and unusual harm. They weren't saying punishment. They were using treatment instead of punishment. But the idea in John's interpretation was that they're trying to put this beyond the notwithstanding clause by bringing in the notion of cruel and unusual treatment. He dealt with it here, but it looks like they're running the same thing here in Alberta with this letter. You know, they're talking about the harm that is caused to the children, and that's why it violates their rights.
Well, and that's, you know, of course, everyone involved in this conversation should be, if they are not, motivated by protecting the very best interests of children. And the law has always recognized that parents, the ones who bring these children into the world, the ones who care for them day in and day out, are the ones who have those children's best interests at heart. And that does not displace the very rare occasion where there is proof and where there is evidence to show that a particular parent is not doing that. So that aside, the then broad claims of harm to children by, for example, protecting girls' sports for girls and protecting children from life-altering consequences that will be engaged from, you know, obviously surgeries, but then on the hormonal levels through puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, where there's research showing significant risks. And some, you know, for example, the Gender Dysphoria Alliance, individuals who've experienced this personally are saying that the social transition itself is a very significant intervention and can cause harm as well. And so that harm is not what is referenced in these, you know, public communications. It's almost like that harm is being ignored for a view that there's an emotional level of harm that comes when someone isn't immediately affirmed in a particular identity that they are claiming in the moment.
As there's a no child. Limiting
as a child. That's right. So, yeah. But there's no limiting principle to that, Kevin, is there? Like, if we can claim a particular identity as a child, and many of us have at different times, what is the constitutional limitation on affirming someone not just as a boy or not just as a girl, but as a different age, as a different race, as a different species? Like, those are all questions that one might raise when it comes to identity and expression protections. And especially when you're dealing with children, to remove the reality of parental care and involvement in those conversations is to mean that, well, now these children are untethered from those who have the responsibility to care for them. Because once you start down a transitioning path, expert evidence, including which was provided in the Saskatchewan case by a trans doctor, Dr. Erica Anderson, was to say, like, look, this is a very important area where there's a need for professional help. And this is from a doctor who's been involved in the transitioning of many people, including many minors. And so to avoid that reality from the conversation and think that this is something that can happen without parental involvement violates constitutional principles, violates, you know, a considered view of the medical consequences, and is really based on, you know, I think in Canada we can say there's some significant activist research that's been pushed on these issues. There's a Dr. Salway, a Dr. Travers, and Dr. Sywick, all here in Canada that are pushing this narrative, all of them claiming significant harm. But it's this claim of harm without understanding the significant realities of many people's lived experiences, including people who have transitioned and said, look, we were not aware of the significant harms that we were being motivated toward. You can think of the story of Lois Cardinal, an individual who, even as an adult, said, look, I was not aware of how damaging this would be to me, and even applied for medical assistance in dying because of the consequences of that. You know, and then there's to think that this is a choice that we should be using our medical system to put minors on that path without, you know, safeguards, I think is an issue. But the reality is, Kevin, in the courts, there is no guarantee that the courts are going to uphold parental rights ultimately. And in the Saskatchewan case, we actually saw almost a complete lack of appreciation or a lack of even weighing that parental responsibility and the right of children to the care of their parents by the court, because the court actually took an injunction decision, which is kind of a gut check decision by a court, and struck down a government policy. Now, normally government policies are protected by a presumption that they're in the public interest. And so a court can't just strike down a government policy because it doesn't like it. And especially on an injunction where it's like, we haven't even heard all the evidence. There hasn't often been cross-examination. The court is, you know, supposed to accede to, well, there's a public interest in the government, we're not going to interfere with that lightly. But in this case, the government was saying, look, our public interest is based on the fact that we've passed this policy, and also that, you know, parents should be involved in their children's lives in school as a presumption. And the court struck that policy down on the basis of essentially novel views on Section 7 and Section 15 rights, and this view that there's going to be this harm without the consideration of whether there's harm on the other side. Harm not only, of course, to the parental-child relationship, but harm that parent involvement could keep children from experiencing. And so our legal system is under stress, I believe, when it acts against government policies, especially on an injunction basis, and then is beginning to prioritize essentially new progressive interpretations of constitutional rights on the basis of non-enumerated terms. Gender identity, gender expression are not even terms within our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, in order to strike down and to, in some cases, just ignore the prior existing common sense protections for the parent-child relationship. And it's been a longer standing trend in Canada, especially in the West, to find that Canadians' trust in the courts is really at an all-time low, and possibly for good reason.
Well, I was going to use an old phrase when they talked about this type of thing in the past. It was referred to as an activist court. In other words, it wasn't relying on necessarily precedent or what had gone before, but was bringing up novel interpretations of things. And that is what I think they will have to rely on here, from what you're saying, if they're going to side with the side that wants these drastic changes. Because, it seems they're going to have to decide what are the best interests of the child. That's what it comes down to. Because the people that are supporting these transitional policies, they're the ones claiming that they know best what's best for children. And children know what's best for children, and parents don't.
Right, which is, a presumption which goes directly against the constitutional foundation of our law, of our common law, and of our charter. Up to the present. But when you see that it's not simply, an activist court, but you could see the legal system as a whole, as you're mentioning this article, being tainted with a bent toward these new progressive views of rights. And once your legal system begins to pick a side, let's use the term progressive, because that's the side the court itself has claimed. We've heard, I think, many times the fact that our Chief Justice in Canada has claimed that the courts in Canada are the most progressive in the world. Well, that's aside, because it's right to view these new approaches being advanced in the courts to gender identity, gender expression as quote unquote progressive. Whether they are in fact progress is another story, but the label progressive does ascribe to them. And when we see legal scholars and others saying, well, these policies announced by Daniel Smith are unconstitutional based on their progressive views, not based on the law that I've referenced, not based on the fact that, our family law system in Alberta has some pretty strong and clear protections for parental rights. The Family Law Act, for example, in Alberta recognizes that parents of children under 18, by the way, not under 16, which is the policies announced by Daniel Smith, but children under 18, the parents of those children are entitled to be informed of and consulted about and make all significant decisions affecting that child. Well, that's very significant. Those are legal principles in the Family Law Act in Alberta. So to now say, oh, no, let's throw that view out because we have these new progressive ideals that push parents off to the side if they're not in step with these new views of identity and new views that gender identity can be untethered from biological sex reality. And, when a court begins to stray, in my view, from established legal principles, and I think we could say that a number of the decisions during COVID certainly began to do that, but trust in the legal system goes down. And when trust in the legal system goes down, it becomes a lot more palatable and in some cases necessary for the legislatures to make legislation that cannot be struck down by the courts via the means of Section 33. So we saw, for example, Scott Moe and the Saskatchewan Party adopt Section 33 language. They said, you know, this protection for children and parents in schools is going to operate irrespective or notwithstanding the Charter Sections 2, 7, and 15. Now, in my view, they probably made a mistake there because they, as you mentioned, they left open this claim. Well, maybe it is cruel and unusual punishment under, I believe, Section 12. But normally what you see is when a legislature is viewing the courts as not acting in the best interests of society as a whole in their decision making, then the legislature under the Constitution of Canada has the reserved right under Section 33 to invoke the notwithstanding clause, actually all the way from Section 7 to Section 15. So none of those rights could be invoked. And that would be a simple solution, for example, for Saskatchewan, if it doesn't want to have to deal with this claim that somehow involving parents in the lives of their children is cruel and unusual to those children. Of course, we always have, as noted, the protection in the law that says if a parent is abusing their responsibility to care for their child, well, then that parent loses the rights. And then the state has to step in to, of course, protect that child. But we'll see what Alberta does because, just to reference Alberta trust and confidence in the courts, I'm looking at a poll, actually, that Angus Reid Institute did. And this is a poll, halfway through COVID, I guess, you're finding, you know, how much confidence do you have in the Supreme Court of Canada? And, you know, it might not surprise you, Kevin, to know that in Alberta, we have the lowest intervals of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada anywhere in the country. In Alberta, people that have complete or a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada, that number was 38%. People that had not a lot or a complete lack of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada, which of course is the ultimate decider of constitutional law, including ruling on, you know, progressive claims of constitutional rights. People in Alberta, 53% of them have not a lot or a complete lack of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada. And that is a very significant number because what you're doing when you're invoking Section 33 of the Charter, the notwithstanding clause, is saying we lack confidence in the courts, including the Supreme Court of Canada, to uphold what we view as fundamentally important issues in our society. You can see that a majority of the Alberta population is already there. If Alberta does not invoke Section 33 in the adoption of these policies, it is no doubt that there will be legal challenges to these policies, and there is a significant likelihood that a progressive court, which according to the Supreme Court of Canada is an acceptable ideological position for a court to take, will strike down these policies. And that is just a reality that the Alberta legislature is going to have to consider when determining how to adopt and enact these policies here in Alberta. If it's like Saskatchewan before, it's likely that there'll be even an injunction decision suspending the implementation of these policies before a constitutional hearing. And I think that's the big political and legal question that is going to be faced across the country for governments that are choosing to act in this area of sex and gender for minors and the protection of women's sports, etc.
I just want to step back, that is in time, in our conversation to the analogy or the equivalence you made between the COVID period and the judgments that came down then and the potential judgments that are coming in this area as well. In the COVID period, when we had judgments on lockdowns, for instance, the judiciary seemed to always side with the harm, potential harm caused by the virus, and did not focus at all on the other side, that is the harm that could be caused by the lockdowns. And I think that's what we're talking about here. You know, both sides in the transgender issue are talking about harm to children. So I guess it's going to be the courts deciding and ignoring whose harm they pay attention to.
Well, that's the real question and the real concern is, you know, there's there's some people talking about like identifiable significant harms. And then there's people talking about a fear of identifiable harms. And so in the COVID space, you're talking about, you know, people getting arrested, sometimes imprisoned for attending a protest or for attending an outdoor church service or any number of different prohibited activities. And, you know, turning to, for example, the BC Court of Appeal, where they were being asked and, you know, in the court hearing saying, look, how can you allow people to gather for an indoor workout class with 25 people? The evidence isn't unclear about the potential risk for that. And there's numbers and there's statistics. And then allow the government at the same time to prohibit two worshipers for gathering outdoors for worship, regardless of safety protocols. Do please explain how that is reasonable. And the court just smooths it over saying, well, there's a risk of harm.
Well, I know that's well,
that. At what point does the public's common sense begin to question the legitimacy of the analysis that the court is providing? And that kind of legal decision making, with all due respect, undermines public confidence in the courts and leads to situations where a government going back 10 years ago, which would never consider invoking Section 33 of the Charter because we hallow the ground that the court walks on and it's right to view the courts as the defenders of the constitutional principles on which a free and democratic society are based. But when the courts are showing that some of their analyses is not really based on these principles, but rather based on their views of what is the best way for society to operate, divorced sometimes from any reasoned analysis on those principles that stands up to the scrutiny, at least that the public is expected to have, well, then the public confidence in the courts, the lack of public confidence in the courts would actually justify legislatures making the political calculation saying, well, invoking Section 33 might not be the wrong move in our society. I can tell you it's a different story in Ontario. In Ontario, you still see more people expressing confidence or complete confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada than people that don't have that level of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada. So I think if you went to Ontario, you're going to see that, you know, the government is probably not going to be politically motivated to invoke a Section 33 notwithstanding clause in order to protect the parent-child relationship, for example, in regard to schools, because the population itself still has a much stronger, at least 10 points stronger position in favor of confidence in the courts than, for example, in Alberta, where there's only a 38% interval of confidence in the courts. And likewise, you haven't seen New Brunswick, you know, announce that it's going to invoke the notwithstanding clause to protect its parental notification policy. That's going through a court process. An injunction application has not been raised in that process, so that policy is in effect, is my understanding. But there, you know, 46% of people in this 2022 study said that they have a complete or lots of confidence in the Supreme Court of Canada. And it was 42% that said they don't, and 46% that said they do. And so, again, from a political standpoint, when your population has more confidence in the courts, then you're probably going to let the process play out more in the courts and rather than invoking the notwithstanding clause.
Even though you noted that New Brunswick isn't invoking the notwithstanding clause and doesn't appear to be heading in that direction at the moment, do you see sort of a change coming in the country with it being used more often because of cases like this?
Yeah, I think that's the real fundamental observation that I have, is that we are potentially on the verge of a very significant shift in constitutional law in Canada, given the low intervals of confidence, especially from a Canadian perspective, expressed in the Supreme Court jurisprudence, which defines the constitutional rights for the country, and given the controversial nature of, you know, quote-unquote progressive stances on the parent-child relationship and on issues of sex and gender. And so if Alberta follows the lead of Saskatchewan and invokes Section 33 on these issues, you know, clearly I think it would be politically palatable, given the low interval of confidence in Alberta in the courts. But if it does that, I think we will see almost all policies that may or could be viewed as, you know, more traditional or supporting the family kind of policies being adopted through the use of the notwithstanding clause to avoid activist litigation against those kind of foundational principles. And it's kind of a twisted place for me as a constitutional lawyer to be in when you recognize that, you know, our constitutional law and our Supreme Court have in the past been some of the most ardent and clear expositors of the reason and the importance of protecting the parent-child relationship. I mean, we've seen courts, for example, in Newfoundland, where the judge in that case dealing with a family that, due to their religious convictions, objected to all sorts of, you know, necessary medical care. And the court said, look, I don't appreciate these parents' views at all, especially when they have objective harm to their children. But you as a medical community can't be operating on a child without fully informing and gaining the consent, if possible, of those parents, because that child's right is protected through their parents until they reach the age of majority. That is the charter right of the child. That is the liberty and security interest of the child to the care and protection of their parents. That is where Canadian law has been. And so now to see our courts almost recoil from that, particularly with this decision of Justice McGaugh in Saskatchewan, but earlier decisions of Justice Kubik in Alberta, dealing with a parental secrecy policy in schools and then up to the Court of Appeal as well, where you saw the courts almost recoil from the idea that parents should be, as a presumption of the rights of the child and, of course, the responsibilities and rights of the parent, involved and informed. If there was any doubt, for example, in Alberta, there can't be, because our Alberta Bill of Rights protects the right of a parent, even in school situations, and particularly in school situations, to make informed decisions concerning the education of their children. In spite of that, we've seen courts recoil and almost avoid or ignore that important weight of constitutional authority that protects that relationship. And so now to see that in order to protect that constitutional principle, legislatures might actually have to invoke the notwithstanding clause to protect courts from overruling their own prior established constitutional principles is concerning. But, you know, the reality of the situation might call for it, both from a constitutional and legal perspective, and clearly from a political perspective, when you're recognizing that, you know, there's significant support. Once people understand these issues, there's significant support for safeguards. There's significant support for involving parents in their child's fundamental life decisions about medical care and about transitioning and changing their names, rather than simply involving the teacher or the counselor or the teacher assistant or whoever else might be the quote-unquote adult in the room. That is not how people want to view the benefit of the children and the best interests of the children. Is it going to be viewed as protected best by the thought of an individual who encounters them once a day or once a week? Or is it going to be best viewed through the lens of the parents who dedicate their lives to raising that child, who get up in the middle of the night, as I was last night, to help a child who's not feeling well? Like, which perspective is going to have more weight in law and policy and in constitutional terms as well?
It sounds like you're saying that, you know, this is going to be a political fight and the courts are just sort of preamble to that. We're going to have the fight in the courts and then it's going to be a political fight. That happened in Alberta to a certain extent with the gay straight alliances, because that was supported by the courts, and then the government was changed and they withdrew the bill. So that ended up being a political fight. Is that ultimately what you're saying? You know, I mean, it's not futile, I suppose, to fight them in courts, but you sounded really sort of down when you started talking about that injunction in Saskatchewan, Marty.
That injunction in Saskatchewan, to me, reading that decision again, there's almost no constitutional weight placed on the important role that parents play in the lives of their children. And rather, all of the weight is placed on a theoretical harm that is said to be borne out by evidence that is produced by some activist associate professors with, the quality of those studies has been greatly criticized. But when a judge says, well, look, we're going to, and it wasn't so much that the judge was weighing this evidence, it was that the judge was ignoring the constitutional weight of the parent-child relationship, saying, well, of course, parents are out there and that's a policy of the government, but failing to recognize that there is such a thing as parental rights in Canada. And that's not to say that, we don't care about children's rights, but the reality is that parental responsibility to protect children's rights is what parental rights is all about. It's a two sides of the same coin kind of concept until, you can prove a rare exception when there's evidence of an actual violation by the parent of that sacred parental responsibility. And so, yes, I do think that, we may be in a place where legal cases on this issue are sidelined by exercises of the notwithstanding clause. We will see what Alberta does, but, referring back to the situation in Alberta a number of years ago with the case that I was involved in starting around 2018, where, an injunction was brought against a government policy, and that government policy mandated secrecy. School officials were not allowed to tell parents what was happening in various clubs and activities. And the whole case was not, whether gay straight alliances are necessarily good or beneficial. It was mostly about, can the government prohibit parents from being notified? And, the court below on an injunction application, again, one of those gut check decisions, said, no, we actually view that there's children's rights against their parents that could be violated. And it was just a bizarre kind of view that somehow a child, a minor, an unemancipated minor, there's ability under the Family Law Act for a child to be viewed as essentially being freed from the care and protection of their parent. They're viewed to have enough responsibility and maturity to make decisions for themselves. But we're not talking about those situations. We're talking about a minor, a child, anywhere from 5 years old to, up to emancipation, whether that's 16 or whether that's 18, a parent not even being able to know where that child is going for a club or an activity, sometimes even off of school grounds. And the court's response to that was, well, we must protect the secrecy and the privacy of a child against their own parent. And it's, some of that bizarre reasoning started to indicate to me that, we've lost the plot when it comes to protecting the best interests of children. If you view as a general rule, not a rule applied particularly in specific cases where there's evidence of harm, but as a general rule that keeping parents in the dark is the right thing. And that's what the government of the day was pushing for. Now, of course, that was decided when the School Act was revoked and the Education Act was proclaimed in Alberta, which did not include those specific secrecy provisions. Now, the reality is that many school boards in Alberta continue to maintain those kinds of practices and policies, which keep, as a default, parents in the dark. We're never talking about the exceptions here, which, law would recognize, but keep parents as a default in the dark. It's against all the legal principles that are there. But when our law starts to stray away from its foundational legal principles, and not just foundational legal principles, you can go to the Bill of Rights in Canada, and I think it actually has some interesting things to say about this, and I'll just bring that up, Kevin.
Okay.
So yeah, bringing up the Bill of Rights in Canada, we see that this is a statement of the federal parliament. And of course, I've already mentioned the statement of the Bill of Rights in Alberta that parents have the right to make informed decisions concerning the education of their children. But the Canadian Bill of Rights as well recognizes a similar protection for the family. And so, of course, here, the preamble to our Bill of Rights, this passed under John Diefenbaker and the parliament, said the Parliament of Canada affirming that the Canadian nation is founded upon principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God, a very common statement also found in the Charter, the dignity and worth of the human person, and the position of the family in a society of free men and free institutions, affirming also that the men in institutions remain free only when freedom is founded upon respect for moral and spiritual values and the rule of law. And so you see there a legal philosophy upon which Canada was founded, which, you know, finds its reflection, of course, in the reality of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which recognize that Canada is a free and democratic society, you know, founded upon principles which recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. But you see there also this concept, which, again, foundational concept in Canada, that recognizes the position of the family. And what we're seeing in some of these cases and some of these critiques is a lack of recognition of the position of the family in law. We in Canada recognize that there's different jurisdictions of authority, and sometimes these have been blurred. Of course, you have the federal parliament and the current federal government seeking to exercise authority over almost every area of your life, whether it's the straw you get from the fast food restaurant, how much tax you pay on your gasoline, or, you know, I think the federal government has even expressed quite a few views on this particular issue of parental child rights in schools, which is, you know, not within federal jurisdiction. But in law, jurisdiction is an important concept. The federal government has a limited jurisdiction. The provincial government has a broader, more general jurisdiction in Canadian law. But not to ignore the importance of those, you know, constitutional jurisdictional elements, the position of the family also has a recognized jurisdiction in law, which means that the state is not the parent of the child. It is the jurisdiction of the family, of the parents, to decide what kind of education will be brought for their children, the faith and the moral values that will be taught to their children. Those are legal principles recognized in our law about a particular jurisdiction, legally respected jurisdiction of the family. And that's really what has been ignored in some of these legal cases, and what is at stake, especially in, you know, the New Brunswick and the Saskatchewan and significant parts of the Alberta policies that have been announced. But that legal jurisdiction of the family is a question that I think, if the law is not going to recognize it, voters, the people that are producing more voters as well, have increasingly recognized, is that we need to see this jurisdiction of the family respected by our schools, by our governments. And when it's not, there is that motivation to invoke, for example, politically, the notwithstanding clause to make sure that that is, in fact, a respected jurisdiction of authority.
I know that people have argued for some time now that the diminishment of the family is a plank of the cultural Marxist platform. And, you know, this is much discussed now, the infiltration of institutions, things like that. Do you see this as sort of a larger trend worldwide, the diminishment of the family in courts all over the world? Or is this just particular to Canada? Are we extreme? How would you put us as Canadians in this argument? You know, are we at least institutionally sort of going towards the cultural Marxist light?
Yeah, I'm not a good authority on the particular ideological bent that may be motivating something, but I can say that, you know, in light of our Canadian legal history and our common law jurisprudence affirmed through our court decisions on the basis of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that this jurisdiction of the family has been recognized as a foundational principle, as something that is essential. And so to have it largely ignored in recent cases, and even, you know, by the critique of, you know, these law professors and their staff that's appearing today, why are those individuals not recognizing this foundational jurisdiction, this principle of protecting children through their parents? This why are they not giving that consideration? Are they recognizing that in their letter? Or are they attempting to create a new paradigm which does not recognize the foundational role of the family and the position of the family in a free society, which is what the Canadian Bill of Rights? So if they are the ones changing the paradigm, legally and constitutionally, I think they owe it to Canadians to say, what are they basing this? Are they basing it on cultural Marxism? Are they basing it on something else? Because just this claim of harm, I don't think that's getting borne out very well in the evidence, as we see very significant stories of individuals attesting to very real harm from the path that these legal scholars and sometimes court decisions are promoting, absent parental involvement and oversight. And so, yeah, it's an interesting question that you raised there, Kevin, but I'm not able to answer it. I say it's a better question to be asking those who would change the legal paradigms upon which our free society in Canada has been founded.
Yeah, they are upsetting the apple cart here by trying to transition to a new paradigm, is what you're saying. They are the ones.
Yeah, I think anytime that you are trying to take away parental involvement with their children's lives, you're the one that has some explaining to do.
Well, hypothetically, then, in a court case, the idea of harm is going to be presented by both sides, right? Presumably. You know, so there has been a lot of a change, I guess, in the last few months with stories coming out in the media about the harm that has been done to people who have undergone transitions. This is the kind of evidence that's going to be presented in court, you figure, by the side that is supporting parental rights. This is the type of thing they're going to argue. Are they going to argue, or both, the traditional role of the parent? You know, are you going to argue both? Here's the harm that has been caused by these transitions without parental oversight, and here is the traditional rights based on the precedent that you've indicated in previous comments.
Right. Yeah. And I think the validity of any legal principle would be shown by the evidence that it, you know, either causes less harm or it protects people from harm. If it's an invalid legal principle, then it's going to result in more harm in the long run. And so ideally in a court of law where full evidence is presented, a judge will be in a position to make that view. What we've seen so far, and we haven't seen any of these cases actually go the distance and actually require a court to dive all the way into the evidence to see the validity of some of these claims. And of course, some of these claims are going to be, vulnerable to, the claims of sort of a broad claim of harm based on shoddy evidence is going to be vulnerable to attack on cross-examination and criticism on by a counter expert. And so, yes, I think in either case, the legal system remains the right place in many respects to evaluate and to have the consideration of the evidence in those cases. The public conversation needs to be expanded on these issues. People need to be informed and engaged on what is actually being talked about, because we live in a very soundbite culture where you hear one soundbite over here and one soundbite over here, but you don't always get to the evidence. And sometimes a court proceeding can be very useful. In fact, there's a view of law that says that even if the Section 33 notwithstanding clause has been invoked to prevent a court from striking down a law, then that court is still permitted to go ahead and decide the constitutionality in its view of the measure without the ability to actually strike down that law. So that may be the case that, and it's highly likely, even if Section 33 is invoked, that legal challenges would attempt to do so, in which case the government could present evidence, other interested parties could come to court and present evidence of the different levels of harm, the benefits, and the consideration of whether involving parents in these decisions of their minor children's lives is valuable or not. And I think that would be a very interesting and significant case. Right now, what we're seeing is a kind of an after-the-fact approach to some of these things, where, you know, for example, in the Tavistock Medical Clinic, where there was many children being transitioned from one sex identity to another, sometimes through surgeries, many times almost always through hormone and puberty injections. Now there's litigation seeking monetary compensation for that, which, you know, once you get to that level of significant harm from a broader population, you know, it's it's concerning because you're thinking, well, now the medical system has failed these young people. The medical system's presuppositions to do no harm has failed when you have many coming for essentially a class action against the medical system and saying, look, we were told this would be beneficial. And in fact, it has done long-term, lifelong harm. And we are demanding significant financial compensation. You're seeing that all across the world now with cases, but potentially better to be litigating these up front and considering what are the issues. If our society needs a broader conversation on that, potentially a court case would be the place to do that. Although right now, if you don't see a Section 33 invocation on legislation dealing with this, the significant risk is that a court would simply strike that down. And then, you know, children wouldn't have that protection of their parents in the different cases where that legislation would otherwise mandate it.
Is that evidence from England and that clinic, I believe it was shut down, is that being used now in litigation? You know, the fact that that was such a travesty and caused such harm that it has been shut down and resulting in all this litigation. Is that being used at all in cases around the world or in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, the individuals involved and the stories that are coming out of that and those situations will certainly be evidence for other cases of here's what happens when you have these kinds of protocols in place. And you've probably heard that one of the reasons why Alberta has expanded this from simply the how do we deal with these transitions in the classroom to is our medical system doing something is because there has been a significant global realignment on these issues where it's saying, well, wait a second. I think the no holds barred approach to transitioning children has potentially caused more harm. And so you've seen different governments in Europe and many different states as well pushing back against a medical system that has been advancing this to younger and younger ages.
Just a local, semi-local question then. What about British Columbia? I know there have been cases, fights between parents and the courts regarding transitions. Do they show any signs of slowing down there, or is litigation going to be proceeding there as well?
Yeah, I think right now the only places that you're going to find significant legal conflicts of the policy nature that we've seen in Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, and likely coming soon to Alberta are places where there's a political capital that says protecting this parent-child relationship is worth braving the controversial storm that's going to be coming legally and politically afterwards. And certainly in BC, you do not see that political capital there. And what you're seeing on the legal cases are really, you know, a parent fighting to, you know, try to forestall particular transitions, whether it's through hormones, etc., and, you know, almost universally failing in that regard. Often those are parental disputes, and one parent is promoting the child to do the transition, the other parent is promoting a wait-and-see approach, and the courts have been siding really with the parents who are promoting this transition on the, you know, the claimed harm that a child who does not receive this transition is going to be more vulnerable to suicide than a child that does. Again, a case of evidence. What is the actual evidence for that claim? And there's been a critique of that. But otherwise, I think that the battle in BC, for example, with the Amy Hamm case, is not so much a battle of can you protect the children? It's a battle of whether you can even have the conversation as a professional in British Columbia saying, is there such a thing as a biological reality of female and a biological reality of male? And that's the criticism of Amy Hamm and her promotion of sex-based rights rather than simply rights based on one's identity.
Okay, yes. Well, as an Albertan, I've always had the view that BC has a difficult time with reality, but that's just my opinion. Okay, Marty, any last thoughts before we sign off?
Well, thanks for having me on for this discussion, Kevin. It'll be very interesting to see where politically and legally this issue takes us.
Great. Well, thanks so much for participating in this episode, just with John Carpe. Look forward to having you on again real soon.
Thanks, Kevin.